Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 387, The Financial War on Terror. This is being recorded on November 17th of the year 2002. It's my pleasure to be joined by Lucy Commissar, who has written on this subject and related topics for, among other publications, In These Times, Salon.com, the Pacific News Service, and Earth Times. Lucy has also had her work featured recently on MSNBC. Lucy, welcome to our airwaves.
Thank you.
Now, the financial war on terror has received a fair amount of discussion after George Bush last fall, that is to say the fall of 2001, made a fairly large public gesture of freezing assets for that were being used to finance terrorism. This obviously in the wake of the September 11th attacks. Now, in your writing about the financial war on terror, you have in your research, you have discovered and illuminated the connections between some of these terror funding conduits and some major financial networks. I wonder if you could begin by developing that general subject for us.
The point is that the same system that's used to move money by the terrorist is used to move money by everybody else, licit and illicit. The part that is used by the terrorist is largely the offshore bank and corporate secrecy system. That's what, if you go to see a thriller in the movies, when they go down to Grand Cayman to stash their money, or if they're checking on their accounts in Panama, they've got an offshore account. It doesn't just mean that it's a place with a beach or a real shoreline, although the word came from the fact that initially they were little islands off Britain, islands in the Caribbean, that were the first places that had these kinds of accounts. But what it really means when people say offshore, because it can also mean Liechtenstein and Luxembourg, it means these are places that allow people or companies to set up bank accounts and not use their real names. The famous Swiss numbered accounts were just so, because you could get an account with a number. And also, along with the phony name or a straw man is what they usually have, or maybe they get their lawyer to write his or her name. They have laws that protect the bank accounts from what they consider nosy law enforcement people from other countries, so that if the U.S. or some other country is on the trail of a drug trafficker or some other criminal and has some evidence that a lot of money has been put in some account in Grand Cayman or Liechtenstein, they can't very easily go and check it out, because they go there and they will be told, sorry, bank secrecy. Well, bank secrecy is what protects criminals. It's what protects people who want to hide their money from taxes. And it's the main reason why the war on financial terrorism hasn't gotten very far and won't get very far until the system is challenged. But the other part of that is that while the administration would like to go after money that's in accounts that is linked to terrorists, it doesn't want to do anything to make it possible to get money that is being hidden by people cheating on their taxes. And you can imagine why. A lot of the supporters of the administration are people who are cheating on their taxes, and they do not want to change this system because they like the system, because they've said it in so many ways. They really don't believe in taxes on high net worth people, on big corporations. Treasury Secretary O'Neill has actually given an interview saying he doesn't think there ought to be taxes on corporations, only on individuals. So that is really the heart of the problem. It's the offshore system. And without going after that system, there's no way they're really going to go after the terror money.
Lucy, speaking of the offshore system and perhaps extending a marine or aquatic metaphor, you've written about one of these networks in particular, the Clearstream Network. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about Clearstream and perhaps, and forgive the terrible pun, some of the banks upon which these waters lap.
Actually, if I can add one, the people in Clearstream call it the river that washes, which also has a meaning. Well, let's think of it this way. People know what SWIFT is. SWIFT is the cash clearinghouse. That is, if you want to send some money, and you're sitting in California or New York, and you want to send some money to Spain or France or India, you don't put it in an envelope. You go to your bank. Your bank sends a wire. The wire goes through SWIFT, and then the instruction goes to the bank in India, for example, telling them your account to the bank, your account in SWIFT now has X dollars, and you can give these X dollars to so-and-so who's going to pick up the money in New Delhi. Money doesn't really change hands. It doesn't go anyplace. It's a bookkeeping matter because one day one bank may be sending a message, they're sending money, but the next day they're receiving money. So the money doesn't travel, but the instructions say your account in SWIFT is you are up this many dollars, this many millions, or you are down, and at the end of the day or the end of the year, it all evens out. So Clearstream does the same thing for financial paper, for stocks and bonds. There are two international clearing houses. Clearstream is in Luxembourg. Euroclear is in Brussels. The story of Clearstream, which was started, sometime in the 60s, 70s, it expanded initially. It was just supposed to be a clearinghouse for euro dollars, but it expanded. And the problem is it was discovered by a man named Ernest Backus, who had been the number three in the bank, that at a certain point the management started setting up secret accounts or non-published accounts. Normally, the records of what money was going in and out of the banks was published record. They had to keep the records. They started setting up non-published accounts, and many legitimate, important big banks, Citibank, Bank of New York, Barclays Bank, were setting up these non-published accounts, and many of them turned out to be in tax havens, in offshore locations, which also had secrecy there. So this was a double layer of secrecy. And he found out that some of these accounts had, they were rather suspicious. In one case, he was fired by the company in the 80s because he began to find out he was suspicious about some of the things that were happening. They were moving money, for example, for the Banco Ambrosiano. That's the famous Vatican bank that collapsed in the 80s. And as part of the story, the Calvi, the head of the bank, was found hanging from Blackfriars Bridge in London. As a sort of a footnote to that, that case is now being reopened. And the Italian justice authorities, based on documents they have found, no longer believe it was suicide. They believe that it was murder.
Lucy,
the family always believed that Calvi was murdered, but now authorities in England are reviving the case, and they think it was murder.
Let me just jump in very briefly. Veteran listeners will recall discussion of the Banco Ambrosiano in connection with the Propaganda Due Lodge. Not only Roberto Calvi, a member of that lodge, but Michele Sindona, who was his predecessor, not only a P2 member, but the advisor to the Vatican Bank. And among the members of Licio Gelli's now infamous P2 lodge was Silvio Berlusconi, currently the Prime Minister of Italy. And that, again, for a mnemonic exercise for veteran listeners who will recall discussion of that. Lucy, I'd like to touch on some of the other specific names and institutions that Ernest Backus came across, but there's a...
Well, let's take the Bin Laden connection.
Sure.
He stayed in touch. He was out, but he stayed in touch with people that were inside the bank for quite some time. And about a year and a half ago, he, together with a French journalist, wrote a book called Revelation, which was revelations about this bank. It caused quite a stir, and some weeks after it was published, the top people in Clearstream were fired. And it's been reorganized, but there's no indication that they have ended the secret account. So one doesn't know whether or not that's just been a whitewash. But the top people were fired, so he was on to something. The point you want to bring up is what other connections there were. For example, he discovered that just before the André Lucy, who had been the CEO who set up this double system, was forced out, Ernest Backus discovered that 16 unpublished accounts were open in the name of the Saudi Investment Company, or SECO. That's the Geneva holding company of the Saudi Bin Laden Group, which is run by Osama's brother, Yeslam Bin Laden. Now, according to the rules of Clearstream, only banks are supposed to have accounts, not companies. What was SECO? What was an investment company doing getting an account? And this was something which ought to raise a lot of suspicions.
Lucy, I had a question. Before we get into some of the other specific islands, so to speak, within the clear stream, again, extending our metaphor, you mentioned a term that's very significant in terms of international finance and in particular some of the shadier aspects of that, and yet one that probably is not well known to most listeners, and that is the concept of euro dollars. I wonder if I could ask you to explain that briefly.
Well, this started in the 1950s, actually, it was euro dollars were invented by the Chinese and the Soviets. They didn't want to have to, you know, dollars are an international currency. They didn't want to have to put their money in banks where the U.S. government could get a hold of them. But in other countries, people found that there was a value in trading euro dollars, and it could be traded for other currency. So these dollars that were held outside had some value. Some banks wanted them. They started paying higher interest than the Americans paid. And then the American corporations and individuals started using them to avoid laws on domestic banks. There would be laws that were set up, we think, for protection of the population, of this population, and required banks to hold to certain regulations, such as, well, for example, if a bank loans money, it has to have a certain percentage of capital in relation to the amount of money that it's lending out, because suppose it's lending out money, and then suppose its depositors all want their money. You have to have something there. Well, these euro dollar institutions maybe didn't require that, so banks could lend out more money, and they thought they could make more money. Of course, if they got into trouble with their loans, everybody was going to be in big trouble, because there's a reason for these regulations. But the movement of the euro dollars was the reason that Clearstream and Euroclear started. And there's a euro money market now. At this point, the Federal Reserve thinks that two-thirds of U.S. currency is held abroad as euro dollars.
And so this again, is a concept that is essential for international finance and for the bedrock of current economics. Lucy, back to some of the islands in the clear stream, so to speak. Briefly, Ernest Backus mentions, brings up an allegation that you wrote about in these times. This, again, from the article Revelations, based on the book by the same name. And that is something called the October Surprise, which has become something of an element in the conspiracy theory dialogue that has taken place. Could you just touch briefly on what Backus alleges about that?
He said that this happened just after Reagan had been elected. And as you recall, people said that Carter had been trying to get negotiate the freedom of the hostages that were being held in the U.S. Embassy in Iran. 52 Americans hostage. And the story was that people from the Reagan-Bush camp went and told the Iranians, don't do anything until after the election, because we're going to make a better deal for you. And it is believed by more people than conspiracy theorists that this is indeed what happened. Well, what Ernest Backus told me was that after the election, a few days before the inauguration, he got a call from an instruction, a joint instruction from the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank and the Bank of England to transfer $7 million in bearer bonds. That bearer bond means it belongs to anybody who's holding it. It's a very easy way to move money because nobody's name is on it. And $7 million in bearer bonds, $5 million from an account of Chase Manhattan Bank and $2 million from an account of Citibank, both in offshore secrecy havens. And the money was going to go to the National Bank of Algeria and from there to an Iranian bank in Tehran. He was told that the $7 million was just a small piece of the amount of money that was being sent around the world and then concentrated in that Algerian bank, and that the transfers were linked to the fate of the hostages. Now, the Fed and the Bank of England weren't members of Clearstream, which at that time was called CEDEL, C-E-D-E-L. And they didn't have any right to order these transfers. Backus, who was the number three at the time, had to make a decision himself because his two superiors were not there. He told the president of the Administrative Council what was happening, and then he acted to execute the orders. And then, of course, after Reagan took the oath of office, 15 minutes after he took the oath of office, the hostages were freed. This is just another bit of evidence of how this organization has been used to handle secret operations.
Now, Lucy, you mentioned, and again referencing some of the information from the explosive revelations in these Times articles, you mentioned SECO and Yaslam bin Laden, the holding company for Saudi bin Laden Group, which is the construction company that is the foundation of the bin Laden economic empire, an institution whose tendrils overlap SECO, the Saudi bin Laden Group, and the milieu of Saudi finance is the BCCI, and Ernest Backus did indeed have some explosive revelations to make about BCCI. Tell us a little bit about what BCCI was and what he had to say about it.
Well, BCCI is the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, and it was set up starting in the 80s. It collapsed. It was at that time the biggest bank collapse in the world. And it was run by some Pakistanis, and it was helped in the U.S. by people like Clark Clifford and Robert Altman and some people in various governmental positions. And basically, it was a money laundering bank for people like Noriega, other drug traffickers. It was used by the CIA. It was a bank that was one of the banks that moved money to Osama bin Laden. That was the banker of Osama bin Laden. After all, it had been started by Pakistanis, and it had an offices in Islamabad. The reason that it was not shut down is because even though the CIA, it was later found, had written reports about how corrupt it was, they did not want to shut it down because they were using it, and I think that comes in a circle today because 30% of BCCI was owned by Khalid bin Mahfouz, who is the brother-in-law of Osama bin Laden. And of the $7 or $8 billion, most of it disappeared. Well, we don't know where it disappeared to, but we could wonder where it might have disappeared to because of the connection of Mahfouz with bin Laden. So I think that's, and of course, BCCI as the other operations also used Clearstream. I mean, Clearstream was the easy way to move paper that you didn't want to have any kind of paper trail about, and some of the same banks that were have gotten in trouble for various other reasons. When you look back at it, you find out that they had some use of Clearstream.
You mentioned in one of your articles that Ernest Baca's remarked that one of the then number two U.S. attorney that was pursuing BCCI and perhaps pursuing belongs in quotes here, and that was then U.S. attorney Rudolph Giuliani, was quite impressed with the documentation that Ernest Baca's was able to provide him with.
Yeah, they did send material to the Justice Department. I'm not sure how much they went into it in detail, because if you read some of the reports that were written later, the Justice Department dragged its heels on BCCI. I mean, Ernest Baca's wondered why nothing really came of the material. He said he tried to send material to the Justice Department, but the Justice Department really didn't go after the BCCI people until Robert Morgenthau, who's the District Attorney of New York then and now. He was the one that made the case move. It was clear that the administration at the time, it was the early 90s, it was exploding through the 80s, and then finally Morgenthau brought the cases in 91 and 92, so that's the Bush administration. They were not going after the BCCI case. It was very embarrassing because the CIA had been so much involved. That came out later because of the work that Morgenthau did.
I would note that the number one attorney above Rudolph Giuliani in the quote prosecution unquote of that case in the Bush administration was Robert Mueller, currently head of the FBI. Going back to some of the financial networks that overlap Clearstream and BCCI, and that also go forward to the Bin Laden network, Lucy, Dunant Magnin and Company, and again a law firm that was dealing with not only Clearstream but also with the Bin Mahfouz family and some of their operations, was one of the things that you wrote about in Explosive Revelations. I wonder if you could tell us perhaps a little more about that.
Well, what you find is that one thing is connected to another thing is connected to another thing, and you can start with Ambrosiano, one of the companies their Swiss division at the time, their subsidiary was the Banco del Gottardo. That is a bank that held the accounts of Al-Taqwa, which is now known to have been a bank moving the money for Bin Laden. If you take it in another direction, SICO and Danand moves has a connection to the Mahfouz family. It's a huge banking family, and one of the main people in that is Khalid bin Mahfouz, who's the brother-in-law of Osama bin Laden, and he's the person who owned 30% of the BCCI shares. In the end, he never would, of course, come to this country to face the prosecution, and there was a deal made where he gave some millions of dollars and never had the problem of, for example, being on an Interpol list, because that might have interfered with his travel around the world if you're extraditable. But a lot of that money has disappeared. We don't know what happened to it. But this same company is connected through a law firm, which is, by the way, under some investigation by the Belgians, and it's connected to SICO, which is the half brother of Osama bin Laden.
Is this the Dunant Magnin and Company, the French law firm?
Magnin Dunant and Partners, and his name is a Geneva attorney named Baudouin Dunant.
And he is the former co-chairman of the board of SICO, or perhaps current chairman?
He's one of the SICO administrators, and he may have well been on the board. Baudouin Dunant is an administrator of SICO.
There's a point that I wanted to develop further in the second side of the program, but very briefly, because we're down to about the last 3 minutes of this interview, Banco del Gottardo was associated with the Banco Ambrosiano. Was that actually part of the same network?
It was a Swiss subsidiary. They bought it. It became the Swiss subsidiary. The origins might have not been Banco Ambrosiano, but during a certain number of years, it was the Swiss subsidiary, and it had a very close relationship in terms of its operations and its leadership.
We will be tying in Banco del Gottardo with the Altaqua Milia in the second side of the program. Now, we mentioned some of these names, Lucy, are not necessarily going to resonate that clearly with members of the listening audience, but the Bin Mahfouz family are not peripheral members of Saudi society. In our last couple of minutes of the interview, I wonder if you could just develop for us a little bit who the Bin Mahfouzes are. Where do they fit in with Saudi society?
Well, they have the Saudi National Commercial Bank, which is the Bin Mahfouz Bank, is the largest bank in Saudi Arabia. So it's a very important bank, and they were very, very influential, and it's one of the ways that banks move money. And so when you have the biggest bank in Saudi Arabia and you believe that the Saudis are moving money to Osama bin Laden, and you are the brother-in-law of Osama bin Laden, it's very clear what is going on. This family has moved money to some of the charities that are believed to have funded Osama bin Laden, and it's a very central factor in the operation. So I think it's the biggest bank, so that makes it pretty important. And they also use the offshore system. They are the bank in Saudi Arabia, but then they operate through the offshore system, and that's how they move their money. By the way, the Mahfouz family is now very worried about some of the attacks on them, and they have hired the law firm of Fulbright and Jaworski in order to defend them against some of these accusations that they have been using charities to move money to bin Laden.
Now, is that the law firm of the late former Watergate and Koreagate special prosecutor?
Yes, I believe so.
That too is a network that has evolved down through the ages. We have been speaking with Lucy Commissar, the author of Explosive Revelations, an article from In These Times on March 15th. Shareholders in the Bank of Terror from Salon.com of that same date, and numerous articles with Pacific News Service and Earth Times. And Lucy's going to be working on a book about international money laundering. We're going to be visiting with Lucy in the second half of our program, but let me remind you that the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com will have a detailed description of For the Record Program 387 in the For the Record section. The Spitfire website is equipped with real audio. You will be able to listen to this interview for a period of a week. Also, note that sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio, and I'm very pleased to announce that as of November 17th of 2002, the entire For the Record series is online. More recent programs streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older shows are available for download only at a longer URL, link to the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website, and to the Spitfire website. Lucy, we'll be continuing this discussion in the second half of the program. I want to thank you for visiting with us. That concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 387. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.